Why would a domestic group dedicated to peace and protecting life be the target of one of the most violent police actions in the history of America? What was the real motivation behind the 1978 and 1985 police actions on the Move House in Philadelphia? What is behind the decision to deny parole to the so-called Move 9, even after they have served their minimum sentence? Is there a campaign to eliminate Move, and why? On this week's Global Research News Hour, as we enter Black History Month, we return to the topic of state and police violence against black people in the United States by focusing on the historic assaults by Philadelphia police against the revolutionary group known as MOVE. We speak to two individuals present at the time of the 1985 bombing against MOVE, journalist Lynn Washington, as well as MOVE member and 85 bombing survivor Ramona Africa. On this week's program, Bombing Black People, the Philadelphia Police's War on MOVE. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of January 29th, 2016. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Since the Russian airstrike began in September 30, 2015 in Syria, the Russian warplanes made nearly 6,000 sorties, destroying significant terrorist positions and their assets. The Syrian Arab Army, or SAA, and the National Defense Forces, or NDF, reportedly took full control of the Arbid al-Judaida district, located near Quiris Air Base, in the northern province of Aleppo. The liberation of the district came after the SAA and the NDF liberated the strategic villages of Qatar and Tal Hatabat late last week. The Syrian troops are reportedly preparing a massive attack on al-Nusra militants in the coming days to break the siege of the Shiite-populated towns of al-Zara and Nubal in northwestern Aleppo. Having lost their advantage in western parts of the country, ISIS command has now decided to concentrate its forces on trying to seize the city of Deir ez-Zor, the largest city in the eastern part of Syria. That comes from the article, Ahead of Syria Peace Talks, Russian Air Force Wipes Out 484 Terrorist Sites, Islamic State ISIS Retreats and Redeploys, by South Front, posted January 27th. The business of vaccines is soon to become a major source of profits for the world's largest pharmaceutical corporations. A press release, Business Wire, January 21, 2016, published by MarketWatch.com, says that Technavio, one of the leading technology research and advisory companies in the world, predicts that pharmaceutical corporations who produce vaccines will reach an estimated $61 billion in profits by 2020. Today, the vaccine market is worth close to $24 billion. The report titled Global Human Vaccines Market 2016 to 2020 gives an in-depth analysis of the possible revenues and emerging market trends globally. What is interesting about the report is that pharmaceutical corporations are targeting Latin America and the Caribbean with its new vaccines soon to be on the market. That comes from the article, Big Pharma and Big Profits, the Multi-Billion Dollar Vaccine Market, by Timothy Alexander Guzman, posted January 27th, originally appearing at Silent Crow News. On Tuesday, Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov was notably frank, saying, quote, The policy of restraining Russia continues, though it is high time to drop this policy and file it in the historical archives, unquote. Lavrov highlighted Washington's counterproductive and dangerous policy, quote, building up U.S.-dominated NATO's military presence near our borders and the creation of global European and Asian segments of a global U.S. missile system, unquote, threatens world peace and security. The bulletin of the Atomic Scientists' Doomsday Clock stands at 3 minutes to midnight, reflecting the high probability of global catastrophe. That comes from the article, U.S. Wants Russia Transformed into a U.S. Vassal State, Doomsday Clock is 3 minutes to midnight, by Stephen Lendman, posted January 26th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. The only aerial bombing by police ever carried out on U.S. soil was on May 13, 1985, when a Philadelphia police helicopter dropped military-grade explosives on the house run by a group of self-styled revolutionaries known as MOVE. This group, founded by John Africa in 1972, was composed mostly but not exclusively of African Americans. They rejected the norms of 20th century American society in their dress, grooming, diet and lifestyles, and had come in conflict with authorities on several occasions. The 1985 bombing claimed the lives of 5 children and 6 adults, including founder John Africa. An adult named Ramona Africa and a child named Bertie Africa were the only survivors of the assault. More than 250 people in the predominantly black middle-class neighborhood were left homeless, after more than 60 other homes were destroyed as a direct result of the aerial bombing. This attack followed a previous assault on August 8, 1978. A police raid on the MOVE house, then located in Powelton Village, resulted in the death of police officer James Ramp. The courts held 9 MOVE members responsible for the death and sentenced them to 30 to 100 years behind bars. 37 years later, 2 of the 9 have died in prison under suspicious circumstances. Supporters of the MOVE 9 are appealing to the Philadelphia Parole Board to set the remaining 7 members free now that they have all served their minimum sentences. In this installment of the Global Research News Hour, we will examine the attacks on MOVE in the context of a history of police and state repression of the black minority population of the United States. The aforementioned Ramona Africa served 7 years in prison on riot charges in connection with the incident. She and other plaintiffs eventually received a $1.5 million settlement from the city in connection with the incident. Today she acts as a spokesperson for MOVE. Our interview with Ramona will air shortly, but first we speak with a journalist who covered MOVE almost from its beginnings. He will put the 1985 bombing and the events that led up to it in their proper context and establish the failures of the media in holding those in authority to account. Joining us now from London, England, is Lynn Washington. He's an associate professor of journalism at Temple University, an award-winning journalist, and a former columnist for the Philadelphia Tribune. Professor Washington has covered MOVE since 1975. So, Lynn Washington, thank you very much for joining us today.
I appreciate the opportunity, Michael.
Now, Professor Washington, in 1985, for the first time in American history, authorities dropped a bomb on its own citizens. And as it turns out, you were covering the MOVE bombing that happened that day on May 13th, 1985, as it was happening. Now, was there anything in particular about that day that stands out in your memory nearly 31 years later?
Oh, absolutely. A myriad of things, but one of which is the fact that the Philadelphia civil authorities, as well as the police department, sanctioned the dropping of a bomb on a building that was occupied by people, and they knew that children were inside the building. And what was, and what compounded this very ugly situation is the fact that the bomb started a fire, and then they allowed the fire to burn out of control. And in the process, they incinerated 11 people inside that house, five of whom were children aged, I think, 3 to about 13. And then they also ended up burning down 61 homes that left 250 people homeless. And of all of those horrific and calculated decisions that had a catastrophic effect, not a single city official was called to account. The prosecutors in Philadelphia concocted this crazy scheme that Move committed suicide. They didn't attempt to come out of the house, and that completely dismissed evidence that police shot at Move members who were fleeing, driving them back into the inferno.
Now, that seems to be a very incredible incident. Now, it seems to me that, you know, we do have instances of organized crime in the United States, gangs, you know, Hell's Angels and what have you, that are, they're engaged in criminal activity and violence. What threat, what unique threat did Move pose to these authorities that would justify such an excessive use of violent force?
The short answer, sir, is none. The Move had been harassing its neighbors. It had been living in a very unsanitary-like manner. But we have to understand that what happened on May 13, 1985, is not an isolated incident. It was just a continuation of what happened in the 70s, particularly August 8, 1978, when there was another confrontation by the Philadelphia civil authorities and police against Move. That particular incident resulted in the death of a police officer. That evidence that has been totally ignored indicates that police officer was shot by fatal fire. So the police had revenge on their mind when they went out in May of 1985. And Move members had adopted a barricade, come and get us type posture, harassing the neighbors in an effort to win freedom for 9 Move members who were convicted for the 78 incident. And the 78 incident goes back to 1972 when Move first became a visible organization, and there had been a series of continuous clashes between Move and police. So the 1985 was a culmination of over 10 years of, let's just say, bad blood. But we also have to understand contextually that police abuse in Philadelphia has for decades, before 85 and subsequent to 85, been totally out of control. And for the better part, the civil authorities, be they the prosecutorial office in Philadelphia, city authorities, and even the federal authorities, have not called police to account for their brutality, for their false arrests, and for their murderous behaviors.
Now, the explosive that was dropped on the Move house in 85, it was C4, and police, I mean, even if they're, I mean, you talk about federal agencies sort of not really holding them to account, but my impression is that that grade of explosive is probably not in the regular arsenal of the Philadelphia police. Does that not point to some higher level of complicity on the part of federal authorities?
Well, it does. And that was one of the aspects of this whole debacle that was swept off the table and I think arguably under the rug. The Philadelphia Police Department here's the story that they said, but then everybody ignored it. The police said that they had a friend in the FBI who traded them C4 explosives so they could play around with it and with the bomb squad to see how it worked and what they could do with it. And then they traded in exchange for this C4 military grade. This is what the Army and the Special Forces and the SEALs and stuff use. They traded back to this FBI agent 38 caliber ammunition. Well, why would that agent need 38 caliber pistol ammunition, revolver ammunition, when at the time the FBI was using 10 millimeter guns and 9 millimeter guns? So the bottom line is that the FBI supplied the C4 to the Philadelphia Police Department. Now, when that bomb was constructed on the afternoon of Monday, May 13, 1985, it was after a morning assault on the police house, on the move house by police, where 10,000 rounds of ammunition were fired into that house during a 90-minute battle. Also during that battle, the police department was shooting so many bullets in that the police, who initially tried to go in and blow holes in the wall of the house, thought that they were coming under fire from MOVE, when they were actually coming under fire from their comrades. And they used C4 to effectuate an escape, and in the process blew much of the front of the house off. So when they finally got around to constructing the bomb in the afternoon, it was hastily done. So they assembled the C4, and then they also used an explosive substance called Tovex. And that was a substance that they usually use in mines to, blow holes in walls so they can, dig coal or gold or whatever. So this bomb was just a polyclot, and they took it up, dropped it from a helicopter onto the roof of the house, and it blew up. It started a fire because there was a 5-gallon can of gasoline on the roof that the police knew about. And the police commissioner said, well, hey, we will let the fire burn to burn a hole in the roof so we can run across the roof with no move, without any move gunfire, drop tear gas into the house to drive the people out. Well, that was a bogus response, because that morning raid where they used C4 for the police to escape and they blew the front of the house off, they could have shot tear gas into the front of the house. So there was no need for the bomb. But again, revenge was the factor, and the just horrific decision to allow the fire to burn. So by the time the fire department started to fight the fire had been raging for between a half an hour and 40 minutes, and it was totally out of control. It was an inferno at that point. And temperatures, according to subsequent investigations, were over 2,000 degrees. And just to be some comparison for your readers, steel, metal, melts at 1,800 degrees. And this fire was in excess of 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit.
Mm. Now, you speak about vengeance as being a major incentive for this particular action. But going back to 1978, when there was that police raid, 9 members of the family were arrested, and I'm wondering if you would attribute a particular motive to the fact that those now it's 7 members who are still in prison. 2 of them died while in custody, but 37 right. years later, they're still. I mean, they were given 30 to 100 years sentence for the third degree killing of a police officer there. What would you assess to be the motive in that raid and in the subsequent long-term detention of these MOVE members?
Well, one, clearly the sentences of 33 to 100 years was excessive. That was an effort to be as harsh as humanly possible on the members of this organization. And when you have a indeterminate sentence like that of 30 to 100 years, you're eligible for parole when you do your minimum, which is 30 years. But they continue to deny them parole, and we can get to that in a minute. But I just want to say a couple of things. Number one, the founder of the organization, John Africa, was actually killed in the 1985 raid. He was not killed in the 1978 raid. He was actually out of the city at the time. As it turned out, hiding in plain sight up in Rochester, New York. Now, 11 people were in the MOVE house in 1978. And according to police testimony, the testimony from police who were also in the house initially when the shooting started, only the four male MOVE members were firing guns. They were in a basement. They were away from a window, from the windows. So essentially they were shooting out and up. The police officers were at ground, you know, grade level. So the police officer who was killed, the bullet struck him in the back going downward. So ballistically, it's impossible for a bullet to make a turn like that in the air. It's highly unlikely that the bullet was able to ricochet into this person. So the whole scenario is laid out by police in terms of how ballistically it could have happened, just was scientifically improbable. So I'll just leave it at that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of the 11 who came out of the house, one was the MOVE 9 decided to go to trial as a family, as a unit. There was another MOVE member who broke herself off from the group. She was acquitted totally of all of the charges that came out of the 78 event. She was represented by a lawyer. There was no evidence that she did anything other than hold her babies when this happened, and she was acquitted of those charges. There was two other women who were not MOVE members. One woman, charges were dropped against her within days of August 8th of 1978. The other person was married to a MOVE member who's still incarcerated. She went to trial, and she was acquitted. So the bottom line is that there was very obvious insufficient evidence against the women. When they went to trial, the trial was really a farce. I mean, MOVE tried to represent themselves, and as the maxim in American law goes, an attorney who represents himself as a fool for a client. MOVE's position was that they were going to put the system on trial instead of trying to get themselves off. The judge eventually started tying MOVE members up and putting tape over their mouths. They brought lawyers in, and it just became a fiasco. And in the end, the judge says, well, listen, I find them guilty. And because they came in as a family, I'm going to sentence them as a family. That turns any notion of jurisprudence on its head, because the punishment is supposed to fit the crime. And to say that the women who were unarmed and just holding babies were as culpable as the men who were armed is just ridiculous. But that is the so typical of the perversions that occur in American law, in American courtrooms. And again, this is something that happened in Philadelphia that time, but it has happened in many cities for the decades after that. And it had been policy and practice across the United States for decades before that.
Now, it seems like the arguments that are put forward by authorities, they seem pretty absurd on the surface. So I think that does point to a certain level of complicity on the part of the media, that those absurdities aren't more evident. Could I get you to comment then on just how and why media has failed to hold up their end in terms of holding these authorities to account?
Well, in America, the media is supposed to do primarily two things, and this is why they have the First Amendment protection. There's a provision in the First Amendment called freedom of the press, and founders of the United States, the people who put that Constitution together, as well as the Bill of Rights, felt that the media needed to do two things. One, provide information such that people in a democracy would know how to make informed decisions as to who's going to represent them. And the other purpose was for the media to be the watchdog, for the media to look at the legislative branch of government, the judicial branch of government, and the executive branch of government at all levels of government to make sure that the government is operating in the interests of the people. The reality is, from the time that the First Amendment was adopted in the 1790s, the media has failed horribly in terms of holding the government accountable. Yes, there have been stellar examples of the media performing a watchdog role, but on a day-to-day basis, they usually don't. And then when you overlay race and when you overlay radicalism onto this, it's just horrific. if you read the Kerner Commission report that came out in 1968 about the urban riots of the 1960s, there's a chapter in there that you never hear the media talk about. It's chapter 15, and it specifically examined the flaws and failures of the media, and the things, the recommendations, the findings that came out in March of 1968 are as true today as they were back then. So this is a long way to answer your very short question, is that the media in Philadelphia had been absolutely horrid in its probative coverage of the dispute between the city authorities and the MOVE organization. And the coverage pretty much was superficial and reactionary. In 78, the then mayor, Frank Rizzo, the former police commissioner, would come out with some bombastic remark. The media would run out to MOVE, and Rizzo said this, and they would, say a four-letter word, to him. And then that was the extent of the coverage. He never got below the surface to try to look at the dynamics. And that became problematic because the public never got a clear picture of what was going on there. And just to give you another example, last year there was a retrospective at one of the Philadelphia colleges dealing with the MOVE 1985 bombing and burning. And it was occasioned around a documentary film that came out in the past year and a half or so. And one of the panels in this big forum that they had over a couple of days was a media panel. And so they had some of the editors in the local media, as well as some former people. And the interesting thing is that current people on the panel, as well as the retired people on the panel, had covered the 1985 circumstance. So a question came up. Knowing what you know now, what would you do different in terms of the coverage? And to a person on that panel, they said, you know what? Maybe we should have gone out and talked to the neighbors on Osage Avenue and find out what they were, what their problems were. And maybe we should have talked to MOVE. So our takeaway from this is that we need to do reporting. Well, please, you need to do your job. Why didn't you do your job then? Going doing basic reporting, going doing interviewing is what you are supposed to do as a reporter. So now, 30 years later, you say, oh, I know where we failed. We failed because we didn't do what we were supposed to do. That's preposterous. But that is the state of media in the United States. And unfortunately, that's the state of media in too many democracies around the world. You expect poor coverage in so-called authoritarian states. You do not expect and anticipate that in democracies, but that's what happens. And particularly when you have that mix in of race, it really compounds and complicates what should be simple, unbalanced, unbiased, fair, and balanced coverage.
Okay. Well, Lynn Washington, I think we'll have to leave it there. But I appreciate your bringing your unique perspectives to this this issue. And hopefully we can have you back on our show in the not-too-distant future. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for your interest in it, and take care.
Okay. We've been speaking with Professor Lynn Washington, Associate Professor of Journalism at Temple University, an award-winning journalist, and he has covered the MOVE organization since 1975. He spoke to us from London, England.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca.
Ramona Africa is the Minister of Communications for MOVE, a revolutionary organization founded in Philadelphia in 1972 by John Africa. On their website, it states that MOVE is committed to preserving and protecting life and to exposing systemic cruelties which threaten that life. Ramona Africa is also the sole adult who survived the bombing of the MOVE house in May of 1985. She joins us from her home in Philadelphia to talk about MOVE and about the current situation facing the MOVE 9. So, Ramona Africa, thank you very much for joining us.
On the MOVE, and thank you for the opportunity to address your listening audience. It's always been a policy, a goal of MOVE to have people hear about MOVE from MOVE, because people have heard a lot of things about us from everybody but us. So we welcome the opportunity, you know, to allow people to hear about MOVE from MOVE.
Maybe you could tell us in your own words, when you talk about being revolutionaries, what does MOVE stand for?
First of all, the MOVE organization is a revolutionary organization founded by a black man called John Africa. And John Africa brought people together from various races, socioeconomic backgrounds, religious beliefs, all different kind of backgrounds, and brought us together as a family. And the basis of the family in MOVE is life. John Africa taught MOVE something that is completely indisputable, that life is the priority, not a priority, the priority. And this very simple principle of recognizing and protecting life that keeps us alive, keeps us going, is the very thing that has put MOVE in direct conflict with this system.
You've engaged in actions to basically protect life, but you've never actually endangered, you know, lives at all in so doing, correct?
Absolutely correct. And I need to explain a little something here. MOVE is unequivocally opposed to violence. We do not believe in violence at all. But we do believe in the principle of self-defense. Every single species of life on this earth is instilled with, for lack of a better word, a mechanism, an instinct for self-defense, whether it's the quills on a porcupine, whether it's the speed that a cheetah can run or a gazelle can run, whether it's a chameleon who can blend into, you know, its surroundings, its background, whether it's a bee that can sting you, you know, all life is equipped with some form of self-defense. That is the law of life, not man's creation, you know, not man's interpretation, but Mother Nature, God's, mm-hmm. Coordination.
Ramona, could you explain your own understanding of why Philadelphia police attacked your house in 1978 and arrested the 9 members?
Well, the bottom line with that is that they could not stop MOVE. They could not shut us up. They could not stop us from exposing what this system is doing, not simply to human life, but to all life. You know, animals slaughtered en masse for their coats, the mink, the seal, the rabbit, the fox. Our very first demonstrations were at the zoo. That was our very first demonstrations, protesting the enslavement and abuse of animal life, you know. when officials that run this system could not shut us up from exposing what they were doing and explaining how wrong it is, then, you know, they began to attack us at our peaceful demonstrations. And they were peaceful demonstrations. But the cops would come along, as they were ordered to do, and tell us that we could not have a demonstration, a peaceful protest, that we had to pack up and go home. And when MOVE would confront them about it, saying, what are you talking about? You know, what does the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, say except MOVE? You know, you have all these rights except MOVE. You know, and we would confront them, and we wouldn't just, you know, take that kind of attitude and be directed by it because it was wrong. And when these officials, the police, who were the first mode of attack against MOVE, when they realized that they could not fool us, trick us, intimidate us, coerce us, that's when the beatings and unjust jailings began. MOVE men were beat bloody, beat into unconsciousness and broken limbs. MOVE women, the same. Pregnant MOVE women were beat, stomped, kicked into miscarriage. And MOVE took a position, like I told you just a few minutes ago. We believe in the principle of self-defense. We're not going to be a whipping post for anybody, especially when they're wrong and we're right. So the conflict between MOVE and the police and their bosses escalated, and it led to a year-long standoff between MOVE and the city of Philadelphia, where they surrounded our home. They surveilled us, watched us for a year from May 20th of 1977 to August of 1978. They put a starvation blockade around our home, turned off the water, would not allow anybody to give us food. They stopped our mail. They took our trash, and when they got it, when they collected the trash, they would go through it looking for I don't know what. But it is that kind of uncompromising attitude of MOVE and our ability to substantiate our position that really was a thorn in the side of officials. And initially they offered us money. They said, you know, they could give us jobs, give us funding, you know, for things we wanted to do. But thanks to MOVE founder John Africa, we weren't stupid. We're still not stupid or confused. We know that your enemy is never going to do anything in your interest for real. Everything they do is in their interest, not yours. And we couldn't be fooled. We would not take their money, their jobs. We have our direction, and we don't need anything from them. And when they saw that MOVE was uncompromising and could not be bought off, could not be co-opted, that's when they basically made a decision that they had to just exterminate MOVE, eliminate MOVE. And that is what the August 8th, 1978 attack on MOVE was about. People should be clear that it was about exterminating MOVE, murdering MOVE off. It was never, ever about an arrest.
I wanted to bring up the 1985, like, because that does seem to be an incident of them upping the ante, and that is an incident that you lived through, and I'm curious to get your own recollection of the 1985 attack and what you experienced and came away with there?
Well, what I experienced was the clarity that those running this system were pissed off that they had not killed Move in 1978 and that we had not gone away, that we continued to expose them. And they were determined to do in 1985 what they failed to do in 1978. They came out to our home, not on Monday, May 13th, but on Sunday, May 12th, which is Mother's Day in this country, and start setting up to kill Move off. They came out to our home with their sidearms, which are, what, 357 Magnums or whatever. They came out there with M16 rifles. They came out there with sniper rifles, with silencers. Now, why would they need silencers? A silencer is the weapon of an assassin. But they came out to our home with sniper rifles, with silencers. They came out there with shotguns. They came out there with M60 automatic rifles, 50 caliber machine guns. They came out there with the makings of a bomb. They didn't go send for it. They came out there with it. Now, what was Move even accused of? Being bad neighbors? Were we ever accused of murder, rape, molesting children, trafficking drugs, anything like that? No. But they came out to our home armed for war and with the intention of killing every living being in our home. They knew it was children in there. In fact, that morning of Mother's Day, Sunday, May 13th, May 12th, our children had gone shopping with one of our supporters who was going to pick up a few things for us while she was out. And some of our children wanted to go with her. They left. There was no barricade at Osage Avenue, nothing like that. But by the time they came back, the police had a wooden barricade across Osage Avenue, which is a small one-way street. When Gloria pulled up, she was looking like, what is going on? A cop, a black cop named George Draper, who knew Move longer than I did. He was around from the early 70s when Move emerged. He went over to the car. He knew our children by sight. He knew our supporters by sight. He knew Gloria. He also knew what they were setting up to do, what their plan was. He goes and removes the barricade and let Gloria drive back onto Osage Avenue with our children to let them back into the house, knowing what they were getting ready to do. Now, nobody can convince me that their plan was not to kill every Move person, every living being in that house, because they could have kept them out of there. They could have kept Gloria from driving back down Osage Avenue and letting them kids back into the house, but they didn't. They didn't, because they especially wanted to get rid of our children, because they didn't want another generation of Move, a stronger, more committed generation of Move, because they were born and raised in Move. You know, they didn't have the system influence on them that adult Move members have on us from being raised, you know, in the system before coming to Move. So they set up all day all day. I mean, they removed cars from the street. They knocked on doors telling Osage residents to go out. It was Mother's Day. Take your wife, your mother, or whatever, out to dinner or somewhere. And you'll be back tonight. You'll be back in your homes tonight, but we need you to vacate now, you know. Mm. But they went on and set up. And late that night, I don't even really have an idea of what time it was, probably 11 or 12 o'clock at night. The police commissioner, Gregory Sambor, made an announcement. Now, I didn't hear it at the time. Birdie, the young boy that survived the bombing.
You helped him get out, right? It was just the two of you that survived.
Right. He said he heard somebody saying something. He heard Gregory Sambor on the loudspeaker, but couldn't really make out what he was saying. What Gregory Sambor said was, attention move. This is America. He went on to say, you have to abide by the laws and rules of America, something to that effect, and then gave us 15 minutes to come out. Now, like I said, I didn't hear it at the time, but I wonder what he was talking about, because he's going to say, attention, move, this is America. Does he know what children, second and third grade children, are taught America was founded on? On resistance, on revolution. Don't they call it the American Revolution? You know, the people that they celebrate every 4th of July as freedom fighters, as heroes, courageous people who went to war with cops called redcoats, who went to war with the government of the time, which was the English government, King George, you know. And every year they're celebrated for fighting back, for refusing to accept legalized injustice, tyranny. What makes Nathan Hale and Patrick Henry, freedom fighters, heroes, and makes Delbert Africa, Ramona Africa, Pam Africa, Mumia Abu-Jamal, Leonard Peltier, and a whole host of others urban terrorists? What makes us urban terrorists and makes them, the Nathan Hales and Patrick Henrys, etc., freedom fighters? People to be celebrated.
So maybe you should talk a little bit about the Move 9, who now it's down to 7, because two of those members have died while in detention. Merle Africa died in March of 1998, and then was it Phil that died last year?
Phil Africa,
yes.
In January of 2015, last year.
Do you have any thoughts about those deaths? Is there anything about them that...
Absolutely. Both Merle and Phil were strong, healthy men and women. Exercised, ran. I mean, there was nothing unhealthy about them. For them to become sick the way they did and die... And when we question what killed them, you know, what did they die of, we're told natural causes. What exactly does that mean, natural causes? Did they have a heart attack, you know, or what? And with Merle, they changed their story like 3 or 4 times. They said natural causes. Then they said she had a blood clot in her leg that traveled to her lungs. Then they said, no, she died of ovarian cancer. I mean, they just kept changing the story. With Phil, they just said natural causes.
Mm.
Natural causes. We know that they caused our family member's death. And we may not be able to tell you exactly what they did, but what we can tell you is that our family members were and are forced to live under the administration, the prison administration, under this system. They are not allowed to live the way they choose to live as MOVE members. Our family wanted raw food. They said, oh, no, that's contraband. You can't have garlic. That's contraband. But meanwhile, they may not do it now, I don't know, but when I was in prison, they would give you free cigarettes, rollies, they call them. You know, they give you the tobacco and the paper. They would give that to you free, but they're going to tell us raw food is contraband? But we can't have that. But if we wanted cigarettes, we could have them, you know? So what I'm saying is they killed our families. I don't know exactly what they did, but I do know that they took strong, healthy MOVE men and women from our home, took custody of them, and therefore took responsibility for them. So anything that happened to our family, very simply, it's their fault, their responsibility, these officials that put them in jail knowing that they're innocent.
Now,
my family members, as you said, seven of them are still in prison today, 38 years of unjust imprisonment. They've been eligible for parole since 2008. That was the completion of their 30-year minimum sentences. They've seen the parole board 7 to 8 times since their minimum was completed. And every time they see the parole board denies them, saying that they won't accept responsibility for their offenses. In other words, they won't lie and say that they killed Officer James Ramp in August of 78 because they didn't. The other thing that the parole board says is that they show no remorse. How are you supposed to show remorse for something you did not do? When are the people that run this country going to show some remorse for the treachery that they have unleashed on people from the inception of this rotten system here in the United States of America? They're going to demand that somebody show remorse when they didn't even do anything wrong, but history is overrun with examples of the treachery of those running this system. When are they going to show some remorse, take some responsibility, like they want to demand innocent people do? But we're determined to bring our family home. People can go to our website, onamove.com, onamove.com, and you will find the parole board's information. We're asking people worldwide to write a note to the parole board. If you're able, call them and demand the release of innocent MOVE people. You know, pressure from the people really does help when it's consistent and strong and you're coming from a righteous position. MOVE people don't belong in prison. That cop that was killed on August 8th of 78, was standing up on street level, facing MOVE headquarters. My family were all in the basement, even according to police testimony and their report. All MOVE people were in the basement.
Okay.
That cop was shot with a bullet traveling on a downward angle, meaning from above him downward. How can somebody in a basement below you, 6 feet or so below you, shoot you on a downward angle? I mean, physics would tell you, you don't have to be a rocket scientist, but physics will tell you that if somebody was shooting at James Ramp from MOVE, the trajectory of the bullet would have to be upward, not downward, you know? But yet, our family is sent to prison for 30 to 100 years despite their innocence, and the people that murdered our family have business as usual, collect their pensions, still on the police force, some of them, you know? I mean, in one situation, one cop is killed, and 9 MOVE people go to jail with 100-year maximum sentences. In the other situation, 11 MOVE men, women, babies, and numerous innocent animals as well are murdered, and nobody goes to prison, not one cop or official, firefighter, not one official.
Mm.
Now, somebody explain to me how that's possible. Tell me how that's justice, how that's righteousness.
Ramona Africa, I really appreciate your firsthand perspectives on this, and for sharing this the aspects of this situation with our greater listenership. And I think if our listeners want more information, as you mentioned, the site is onamove.com.
People can also email us at onamove, LLJA, for Long Live John Africa, at gmail.com. People can call us. We're not hard to contact. We don't hide behind anonymity. Our phone is 215-386-1165.
Okay. Ramona Africa, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. On the MOVE, and long live revolution, long live John Africa, long live MOVE.
You've been speaking with Ramona Africa, Minister of Communications for MOVE, a revolutionary organization founded in Philadelphia in 1972. Their website is onamove.com.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.